Anybody in our assembly is kind of new devotee here? Kind of new devotee? Okay. Do you know who is Lord Kapila? No. You know who is Krishna? You're finding... Huh? Okay. You've heard of the movie Avatar. Yes, Maharaj, I've heard of that movie Avatar. So, Kapila is an avatar of Krishna. And we're going to be reading a section of the Bhagavatam where Kapila is instructing the means of achieving perfection in Satya Yuga. Of course, the means doesn't change the fundamental teachings, whatever the age is, the teachings are the same. The essential relationship of the living entity with the Supreme and the forgetfulness of that relationship and where consciousness goes instead of where it should go. That's for all ages similar. Modes of nature act differently, but the implication with matter is similar, and the means of extrication through the process of devotional service of particular types. So, Vedic picture of time is that time is cyclical. Go ahead, take it out. Just get it done with. Go ahead. Open the box and do what you got to do. Go ahead. All right. Don't do it. Time is cyclical. There's a wonderful chapter in this same third canto, that's calculation of time by the atom. It's fascinating. Because actually time is eternal. But if you're the Supreme Lord and you want to provide living entities with the opportunity to try to enjoy independently of Him, which is not possible, but you wish to reciprocate with their desire, then you have to create an illusion that there's enjoyment apart from Him. And one of the essential parts of your doing that is you need time that seems to be real, but it isn't. So time begins the differentiation of the material elements and the activation of the modes of nature along with the living entities. And then you have higher grades and medium grades and lower grades of living entities, and time acts differently. So time that's actually eternal moves in circles, small circles, medium circles, and big circles of time. Two parardas equals one day of Brahma. One life of Brahma. And one life of Brahma is, what's the number? 14 billion, 311 trillion, 14 billion years. And that's one breath of Lord Mahavishnu. $311 trillion, 40 billion years. And then another breath. And then, so that's the bigger circle, his breath. And then within his breath, there's a Lord Brahma that's created. And then he lives for that duration of his breath. And the next longest duration person is Manu. So the first of the 14 manus, and that's one day of Brahma's year, of Brahma's life, and that 14, the 14 manus, they last for 71, each one lasts for 71 yuga cycles, each one lasts for 4,320,000 years, and then another 13 following that one, and that's his day, and he takes rest, and that's of equal duration. You get the idea. It's like cycles, and then smaller cycles, and smaller cycles, and smaller cycles. The time is cyclical. The scientists are right. The universe is expanding. And then the universe will contract. And it'll again be wound up in the body of Mahavishnu. That they do not know. But it's expanding from the pores of Mahavishnu, not a Big Bang. And there's so many universes. They're finite, but so many you can't count them all. That's a lot. It's a lot of universes, not just one. And our universe is, amongst the many universes, it's very small. So in each day, in the beginning of the first, or any day of Lord Rama, it begins with one of those cycles. It's Satya Yuga. So one of those 1,000 yuga cycles during the day of Brahma, there's 1,000 of those cycles, Satya Treta Dwarpa Kali, 1,000 of those equals one day. So in each one of those Satya Yuga cycles, there's 14 manus. Right? No, there's 14 manus in each one of those 1,000 cycles. And the first of those is Swayambhuva Manu. Just to put things in context here. Swayambhuva Manu is Manu number one. And Swayambhuva Manu appears directly from the body of Lord Brahma during this beginning of the Satya Yuga, because what Brahma does is he's an engineer. He's like, you know, the dean of all engineering departments. He's got his own university. And electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil engineering, this engineering, that engineering. He's the dean of all of them. And so he gets the knowledge, the intelligence, how to do the creation. He gets the plan. He gets the creative impetus, Srishti Shakti. He gets full knowledge of who he is, self-realization, and God-realization. And the understanding that his service to Krishna, or to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is to make a universe. So he makes the universe. And then he populates the universe. Then he governs the living entities who are populating the universe, especially the human species, through the agency of Manu. Manu is the chief personality amongst mankind. That's why he's called Manu. And he gives the laws of mankind in Manu Samhita. So he's like the emperor of the universe. And that first Manu was born directly from the body of Lord Brahma. He didn't require a wife. I don't know of any man that can do that. Brahma can do that. He just created a son and a daughter. Well, Swayambhuva Manu and his wife, Shatrurupa, were both born from his body and not little babies that grew up. They were adult. And then he informed them of their service. Their service was to be the first Manu, and their business was to assist him. And so two things: help populate the universe with good population, and to give the laws of mankind for the human population. So Swayambhu Manu had two daughters. No, three daughters and two sons. Devahuti, Prasuti, and Akuti were his three daughters. And his two sons were Priyavrata and Uttanapada. So this is described in the third canto. You know, the process of creation and the creation of Manu and his offspring. So before even speaking so much about the sons of Swayambhuva Manu and who became, you know, the emperor under Swayambhuva Manu's care, he speaks about his daughter, or one of his daughters, Devahuti. And Devahuti became the wife of Kardama Muni. Kardama Muni is another direct expansion along with nine other sages. He's one of the 10 sages that were born from the body of Lord Brahma, who one of them was Narada Muni. Of the 10, Narada is the one that remained, you know, not married. And he and the others became married, although they were great sages, and they assisted in the proliferation of species, not just human beings, but very interesting discussion in this canto of the various species from them and their wives. So one of them is focused on, one of the 10 sons of Brahma, Kardama Muni, and Kardama Muni was engaged in austerities, and the process in Satya Yuga for self-realization is dhyana, or meditation, dhyayate in Satya Yuga, meditation. So he was engaged in meditation upon the personality of Godhead. But he wasn't an ordinary run-of-the-mill meditator. He was a pure devotee. So when he was meditating specifically on not only the desire to assist his father, which would then require that he would have a wife, but he had the desire to have as his son the personality of Godhead. He wasn't, like I said, a run-of-the-mill meditator. He was a very special personality. So much deeply absorbed in devotion to the personality of Godhead that the personality of Godhead appeared. I remember last time I was here, we spoke about this. He came riding on the back of Garuda, Lord Vishnu, with his forearms, the symbols of Vishnu in his hands, smiling. Kardama Muni was more than smiling. He fell flat on the ground and stood up, and because he's still in the air, Garuda's wings flapping, and beautiful description of the scene. And they had this exchange where he offered prayers, and Lord Vishnu said in a whole number of things. You remember this discussion last time I was here? Yes. I remember having it with the group of you. Because some of you weren't here, I'll just quickly share. Lord Vishnu said, "You pleased me very much by your pure devotion. Therefore I've come and I'm giving you my darshan. I know what is in your heart, and your heart's desire will be fulfilled. You wish that I will become your son, I will become your son. And to have me as your son, you require a qualified wife. Your qualified wife will be here in 2 days, in the forest." No problem, all these things that men and women go through with their marriage arrangements, it was really easy. Lord Vishnu arranged it. 2 days, she's coming, and her father is Swayambhuva Manu. He's going to make a marriage proposal, and you should say yes. Makes it really easy. And you should say yes. And she's as qualified as you are. Here's her qualifications. And in the course of your marriage, you will have 9 daughters, and I will also appear as your son. And in the course of your living in household life, you will achieve spiritual perfection because you will dedicate everything that you are doing unto my service. You will not become implicated in matter in the course of your carrying out your household duties. So, see you later. And off he went. And Karamamuni was in ecstasy. The Supreme Lord the object of my meditation and devotion came and spoke to me. And he'll come as my son. So he knew ahead of time everything. His whole life was all laid out. At least the basics of it. Sure enough, 2 days later, Swayambhuva Manu came. Wonderful section where the king is being received by the sage and honoring the king. You know, the brahmana is honoring the kshatriya. That happened first because the brahmana was the host, so he honored his guest first. And then wonderful appreciation of the king, Swayambhuva Manu. And then Swayambhuva Manu honors the sage, who's going to be his son-in-law. He makes the marriage proposal. Karamamuni speaks appreciation of his wishes, and it's basically a conditional yes. And his one condition is that after Devahuti has a son, and the son then becomes of mature age to look after Devahuti, then according to Vedic direction, I would like in advance your permission that I can then return back to the forest and live the life that I'm living now. But your wife, your daughter, will be taken care of. So that it was settled. Devahuti's standing right there, hearing the whole thing. And right there in the forest, the wedding takes place. You know, from the capital, different royal this and that and the other thing, procedures and facilities are set up, and they're married. And she stays with him. Some time later, Swayambhuva Manu goes back. It describes very nicely the feelings of separation from his daughter that the father felt after giving his daughter in marriage to Karamamuni. At the same time, he understood she was in superlative care. And so there she remained for some thousands of years, because this is Satya Yuga, where lifespan is longer. And she just served her husband very happily with all of what he was doing. And in the course of so doing, she became lean and thin and emaciated and matted hair, and you know, all of her royal comforts were completely gone, and she was happy. She chose, oh, by the way, she chose her husband based on what Narada Muni had said to her father in Devahuti's presence. I think a very suitable husband for your daughter would be Karamamuni. He has these qualifications, da-da-da-da-da-da. And she went, woo, 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 I'd like to marry him. And so the Swayambhuva Manu accepted the desire of recommendation of Narada and the desire of his daughter. So there she is living, serving her husband in the forest. And she wasn't feeling inconvenienced at all, because she understood the reason that she wanted to marry him was his qualification, and she understood his incredible qualification. So after some thousands of years of doing that, Karamamuni expressed to Devahuti, I know that your desire is that you would like a child, so I will facilitate that. And with his mystic power, because he was not only a devotee, he had many other credentials, like he had mystic power. So he created with his mystic power, he created a mystic city, C-I-T-Y, not city, S-I-D-D-H-I. He created an aerial mansion, like a flying city with streets and avenues and buildings. And and, you know, a place where they could live. And she arranged for her to have attendance and dressed her in royal garments and, you know, everything, jewels and clothing. And they lived like that for some time, and the daughters were born. The daughters were then distributed in marriage. Brahma came, and he requested that the daughters of Kardamoni Devahuti be given to others as qualified wives, and then he indicated that, again, confirmed that the Supreme Lord will appear as your son. And he did. And his name was given as Kapiladev. So Kapiladev was Vishnu, or is Vishnu, an incarnation of Vishnu, who is called, amongst avatars, he's called, the type is a Yuga avatar, meaning he gave the primary means for spiritual perfection for Satya Yuga. We say like that about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He's the Yuga avatar for the sage of Kali through the chanting of the holy name. So for Satya Yuga, the process was Jayate, or meditation, so he gave that process. And Kapiladev, when he became matured and grew up, Kardamuni, following the commitment he had already received from Devahuti's father, he left home and left his wife in the care of Kapiladev. And after having been with her husband for thousands of years, she was attached. We get attached to, you know, someone or something really quickly. Thousands of years, we can only imagine a pure devotee husband. He's very attached. But he's gone. And she knows why he's gone, but she's feeling the discomfort, the pain of separation. And so she asks her son, please help me. I know that you are the personality of Godhead. Imagine having a conversation with the personality of Godhead like this, saying, I know you are the personality of Godhead, although you've appeared as my son, and I'm sure that you can relieve me of this anxiety, this great difficulty I'm experiencing, the attachment to family. Overly attachment, I can't even think straight. And my intelligence is bewildered, and my whole sensibility is disturbed. And I know that it's your illusory potency. So since it's your illusory potency, surely you can withdraw it. Can you please withdraw it? Please. Please give me the means by which I can become relieved of delusion caused by the illusory energy. So the whole instruction of Kapiladev, part of which we're going to be discussing, is in response to that question. We discussed something this morning, and, you know, there's several chapters of discussion in response to that question. But it's a classic question that essentially Arjuna is asking. He's asking, please instruct me what is my duty, but in order to understand what is one's duty, one has to be freed from delusion, because otherwise, even if someone tells you what is your duty, this will be understood as that. You know what I mean? The filters. You won't hear what is said. You'll hear according to your conception of life. So in order to get a spiritual, in order to understand what is one's duty, you must operate with a spiritual conception of life. Otherwise, you'll have a distorted understanding. The example, the Bhagavatam example is given is the sun and the reflection of sun on water where there's wind. So if you look at the reflection of the sun on the water and there's wind, is a distorted reflection of the sun. It's not the sun. Not who you are. And that's the kind of conception that we operate with. The distorted, perverted reflection is the language that Prabhupada often uses. So in order to relieve one of whatever it is one's sense of duty is, how do I deal with such and such circumstance of life? Well, go back and hit the reset button and make sure you have a spiritual conception of life. And if you don't, then work on it. And if you do, then you can go forward with what do I do in this circumstance of life. We have to deal with the fact that we're embodied. We have a psychophysical nature. But even when we're trying to apply ourselves according to our nature, we must not forget, if we're going to be Krishna conscious and carrying out the duties of life, we need a spiritual conception of who we really are, because the higher sense of duty is to connect with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the instructions that this section, all this is background to lead up to the verse I'd like to discuss this evening. It's just a continuation from this morning's verse. But it's Kapila Dev assisting Devahuti, like Krishna is assisting Arjuna, in order to understand what is one's duty, in order to be relieved of the bewildered condition due to overly attachment to the temporary, affinity for matter, or in Sanskrit it's asat trishna. It's a nice term. Trishna means thirst, and asat means the temporary. So the thirst for the temporary. If you read Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Hari Nam Chintamani very carefully, you'll find that we're all chanting the holy name. I assume we're all chanting the holy name. And according to Hari Nam Chintamani, written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, the acharya for the holy name, Haridas Thakur, says there are anarthas that prevent us from chanting the holy name properly. Or there are three causes of anarthas. You know what anarthas are? Things that are impurities of heart. And because of our being influenced by those impurities of heart, we don't chant the holy name properly. The language of Harinam Chintamani is they obfuscate or block the pure holy name, just like the clouds in the sky block the direct rays of the sun. The sun is there. You can understand the sun is there because it's daytime, but you don't get the full benefit of the rays of the sun when there's clouds in the sky. Similarly, we don't get the full benefit of the chanting of the holy name when there is anarthas in the heart. So in order to remove anarthas, it's important to know what's the source of them. And there are three things that he indicates that are the source of them. And asat trishna is one. Thirst for the temporary. Hankering for material enjoyment. Or so many nice terms. Affinity for matter. About one of Prabhupada's terms in the Bhagavatam. Affinity for enjoying matter. So, this section is, another one is Hridaya Dorbalyam. Dorbalyam is weakness. Bala is strong. And Dorbala is weakness. And Hridaya Dorbalyam is weakness of heart. It's a phrase that Krishna uses in Bhagavad Gita also. Where he asks Arjuna, how is this petty weakness of heart overcome you? You're an Aryan. You know the higher purpose of life. So one who knows the higher purpose of life and doesn't act on it Why? One of the reasons is Hridaya Durbalyam. I know what should be done, I don't do it. I know I shouldn't get angry, but... and other things that we know we shouldn't do, and then we do them. Weakness of heart. Thirst for the temporary. I forget the third one. Another nice one. So, as these things are being taught in Bhagavad Gita, they're elaborated upon very wonderfully by Kapila Dev. And we just heard this morning about a very, well, it's part, there's a sequence of verses that are, Kapila Dev is explaining to Devahuti, using the metaphor of the sun, one should understand oneself as one understands the sun. Then he gives this example of the sun in the sky that's reflected on a pot in the room, and the reflection of the pot in the room shines on a wall. So if you see the light, the reflection of from the pot on the wall of a dark room, you'll understand the sun is there, even though you're not seeing the sun. And if you just see the reflection on the pot, just go look at the pot, see the reflection in the pot. You know the sun is there, although you're not seeing the sun. The presence of the sun can be understood indirectly by inference. And similarly, he goes through this whole discussion of the modes of nature. They're activated by, or they're under the direction of the Supreme. Just as Krishna says, Maya Jakshena Prakriti, Suyate Sa Characharam. But whether moving or unmoving, all living beings are an influence of material nature which is under my direction. So we see the material nature moving, we can know it's under Krishna's direction. Just like, you know, the fan is spinning. So we can say, well, why is the fan spinning? Because someone turned the switch on and they paid their electric bill, and, you know, so that's why the fan is spinning. Someone made a motor, and so, but keep going. You know, ask, you know, where'd that come from? Where'd that come from? So ultimately everything comes from, if one has a proper approach to life, if you have a spiritual conception of life, everything comes from some source. That's Vedanta. Search for that from which everything comes. So Kapila Dev is, in this Bhagavatam, is teaching everything has come from the Supreme, and one can understand the presence of the Supreme within the modes of nature. And then the modes of nature are activating the mind and the intelligence and the false ego. So even with the false ego, he states explicitly, one can see the Supreme Lord even within false ego. I mean, normally when we see somebody exhibiting false ego, we don't think of Krishna. We think of, what's wrong with this person? Too much. What do I do about this person? For what Kapila Dev is, if we take away that, you know, my happiness is at the center and Krishna is at the center, that through knowledge one can be detached and not just be reactive to the circumstances, but see Krishna. And when you're seeing Krishna, then your intelligence is steadied. The mind is steadied, the intelligence is steadied, and then a proper course of action is easier to follow. In fact, Super Soul can be contacted and he can directly dictate. Not like, you know, he sends you a text message or something, but he can give direction. Intelligence, according to Second Canto Bhagavatam, is the form direction of the Supreme Lord. So the intelligence of Dadami Buddhiyogam Tam Yenamam Upiyantite. In all circumstances of life, how to reach Krishna, whether it's, you know, challenging or comfortable, happy or sad, pleasure, pain, light or dark, all circumstances of life. Kapila Dev is teaching Devahuti. You're feeling, my dear mother, great separation from my father or from Kardava Muni. And here's how your mind can become steadied. And you can be by being fixed in the Supreme. So that's the background. Now here's the verse. This is Canto 3, Chapter 27, Text 14. Well, I'll read the Sanskrit. Bhuta, Sukshma, Indriya Manaha, Bodhi, Adishu, Iha, Nidraya. So, this is the objects of enjoyment, the material senses, the mind, intelligence, and so on. The material circumstances of life. The building blocks of the place around us. And the body itself. Although a devotee appears to be merged in the five material elements, the objects of material enjoyment, the material senses, and the material mind and intelligence, however, he is understood to be awake and to be freed from the false ego. It's not just a rubber stamp, okay, you have neck beats and tilak and you chant a little bit so you don't have any false ego. It's a little more than that. One who has taken the standard, it's the opportunity to go beyond, Bhagavatam is giving us the opportunity to go beyond the external, the necessary vidhis or rules and regulations of bhakti and go to the internal part, the cultivation of attachment to Krishna. And one who is attached to Krishna, the verse is saying, one can move about life, you can be in the world but not of the world, although it may appear otherwise. Here's the purport. The explanation by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu of how a person can be liberated even in this body is more elaborately explained in this verse. The living entity who has become satya drik, that's a term that's used from a previous verse, he can see the Supreme. He can see what's what. And to see what's what means you see the Supreme. To have proper understanding of truth, it starts with a capital T, and then you can have the proper understanding of truth with a small t. You can understand things as they are. So one who has achieved that, the living entity who has become such a drik, who realizes his position in relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, may remain apparently merged with the five elements of matter, the five material sense objects, the 10 senses, the mind and intelligence, but he still is considered to be awake and to be freed from the reaction of false ego. From the earlier section of this third canto in the process of creation, and then again in the previous chapter, when the glance of Mahavishnu is there, it's during cosmic annihilation. All the material elements are withdrawn from their manifest state and they're situated in an undifferentiated condition, pradhan. And the living entities are withdrawn back in the body of Mahavishnu. And he's in yoga nidra. Desiring creation, he glances at that pradhan. Rama Devi, recognizing the desire of the Supreme Lord to again give the living entities an opportunity to regain the fullness of their potential of consciousness and happiness, which isn't happening in that deep sleep condition within his body. Rama, his internal potency, recognizing his desire, she serves him. He doesn't even have to ask. She just knows her master's desire. And so she takes those living entities within his body, the sum total, that's a lot of living entities, samasti it's called, and entrusts that samasti to the halo of the glance of Mahavishnu, Lord Shambhu, along with time energy, because she has subpotencies, and she entrusts that time energy to Shambhu, and he carries the time energy into living entities and comes in contact with Pradhan, and the elements start to differentiate out and the modes of material nature start to be activated. The first element that appears, false ego. So before the living entities even do anything, false ego. So it's the first thing to come and it's the last thing to go. It's got a tight hold on us and we have a tight hold on it. So therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, attacking or shining light on, maybe that's better, the conception of self, because the previous verse was describing or giving the definition, ego means the conception of self, and there's false egos have a misconception of self. False ego doesn't mean just somebody's a macho, swaggering around, showing their biceps and saying, look out, I'm tough. It's not that. That's not false ego. It's thinking of oneself differently than one really is. Like, I'm a body. Or, I'm my mind. Or, you know, some variation and combination of those, other than who we really are, a gross or subtle body. To understand who we are, the false ego has to be overcome. Kapila Dev teaches later, in the next chapter, devotional service, which is where all this is going, devotional service is so powerful and so unique, it can dissolve the false ego and the material mind. What a relief. Like an Alka-Seltzer commercial or something. Or, you know, stronger than dirt, boom, boom, boom. It can really clean away all material contamination, devotional service. But we have to work with a spiritual conception. So one who has that sarvadrik capacity, they can see that because they've gone through the steps of cleansing the mind and receiving the spiritual conception instead of the material conception and continuing, and then this condition is such that even there within the body, they're not identifying with it. They may be utilizing it in various ways suitable even to their nature, but they're not identifying with their nature. They're identifying with their spiritual identity. Same as Lord Brahma. It's really beautiful. I mean, Lord Brahma had all these wonderful realizations about Govinda. He was well acquainted with the ocean of truth. Oh, pure devotee. Full understanding of the absolute truth. And he still wanted to go to the office and do his job. In his case, going to the office to do his job was create a universe. In our case, it's something else, something else. Or go to school and get educated in material society. How to get a job. Anyway, without identifying with it, that's the trick, or that's the art. Here the word lina, L-I-N-A, is very significant. Seeing where that word is. Lineshu. Merged is the translation. The Mayavadi philosophers recommend merging in the impersonal effulgence of Brahman. That is their ultimate goal or destination. That merging is also mentioned here. But in spite of merging, one can keep his individuality. The example given by Jiva Goswami is that a green bird that enters a green tree appears to merge in the color of greenness. But actually, the bird does not lose its individuality. Similarly, a living entity merged in either the material nature or the spiritual nature does not give up his individuality. Real individuality is to be understood, is to understand oneself to be the eternal servitor of the Supreme Lord. This information is received from the mouth of Lord Chaitanya. He said clearly upon the inquiry of Sanatan Goswami, he puts it in italics, a living entity is the servitor of Krishna eternally. Krishna also confirms in Bhagavad Gita that the living entity is eternally his part and parcel. The part and parcel is meant to serve the whole. This is individuality. It is so even in this material existence when the living entity apparently merges in matter. His gross body is made of five elements, a subtle body made of mind, intelligence, false ego, and contaminated consciousness. Then he has five active senses and five knowledge-acquiring senses. So he's just repeating the previous chapter, the 24 elements. So the living, and that's how the final chapter ends, or the previous chapter, rather, 26. There's all these elements, and the living entity is distinct from them, although we may be moving about within them. It's so simple, but it's so major of a step to go beyond being a religious person and being a transcendentalist. A religious person is concerned about, you know, acting virtuously. Like, you know, the message, largely the message of Mahabharata is the struggle between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, or the good and bad, and virtue and whatever the opposite of virtue is, you know, adharma. And there's so many details of dharma and what's to be done and so forth. But right in the midst of all that is Bhagavad Gita that's teaching be transcendental. It doesn't mean disregard propriety or theistic conduct. It doesn't mean that. When Krishna says, abandon all varieties of religiosity, it doesn't mean go, do anything, you know, be irreligious, that's no problem. That's not the meaning. It's there's something that's Paradharma, that's all other points of religiosity should be in pursuance of. And that's the, so to get to that focus, to actually live our lives that way, we can't just be humdrum, we can't be complacent. We have to hear these Bhagavatam messages. And I was asking who's going to be the audience this evening. And I was told it's going to be our regular devotees. So, regular devotees, we should be aspiring for, and the resources being given to us, to go beyond mediocrity and come to transcendence. Don't be complacent. It's too easy to be complacent, but complacency isn't going to carry you to transcendence. And as long as we linger in this world, you know, the unwanted miseries will always be there, and birth and death again and again. And, you know, the real happiness of the soul, the purpose for which creation is brought about by Mahavishnu anyway, it doesn't happen. The higher consciousness. So this is really, really wonderful. It's like a roadmap how to get there. Each of the steps, better than a GPS. You don't have this lady, you know, nagging you. Somebody I know that has a GPS, you can have a man's voice or a woman's voice, and then you can choose your dialect, you know, British English, or, you know, Australian English, or, you know, somebody that's from the south, their English. You still got somebody nagging you. And this is the personality of Godhead. The same as, you know, he is within the heart, speaking to us from outside on how to get to transcendence, you know. In the world, but not of the world. Performing your duties in Krishna consciousness, which means you'll do your duties better than if you weren't in Krishna consciousness, if you're in Krishna consciousness. But without the unwanted misery part that comes from misidentification. It's really wonderful. The gift is really wonderful. But there's some work that we have to do. And it starts with, you know, attentive hearing. And then Shrinvanti, Gayanti, Grinanti, Sadavaha. You have to bring it inside and have your life guided by that. And regular hearing is the means. Hearing with care and attention. But that's the last part. His gross body is made up of, this is the, you know, the transcendentalist devotee who's recognizing I'm an individual even I'm within the material sphere. His gross body is made up of five elements. His subtle body is made of mind and tail. We read that. Even while merged in the 24 elements of matter, he can keep his individuality as the eternal servitor of the Lord, either in the spiritual nature or in the material nature. Such a servitor is to be considered a liberated soul. That is the explanation of the authorities, and it is confirmed in this verse. Prabhupada, like a lawyer, pleading his case before the judge. I rest my case. So any comments or questions? Yes.
On the false ego, say the false ego is the sustaining power of the material world. Any form of I is a false ego, including saying I am my soul. Anything that comes after I is actually a false ego, because even the soul is not our own possession. The I am my soul is also a false ego.
You have another I to put in there? I'm curious. No, then that's impersonalism. I mean, maybe you don't mean what you just said. Maybe you do mean what you just said. But the soul exists, and there is a conception of who I am. So here's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said. It's similar to what Krishna says, but Gopi Bhartar Padakamalior Dasa Dasanu Das. That's who I am. You know that phrase. You've heard that phrase before. Kiva vipra kiva nyasi shudra kene noi. I'm not a brahmana. He was a brahmana. You know, so leaving aside the bodily conception of life, then when you take that away, then who am I? I exist. So it's not if I say I anything, that's false ego. It depends on if the spirit soul connected to the supreme soul in eternal service to those who are engaged in the eternal service, the servant of the servant of the servant, dasa, dasanu das. That's who we are, eternally. And that's not false ego, that's who we really are. There is ego, and there's false ego, there is self. And self-realization is to understand who I am, distinct from who I'm not. And who I'm not is false ego, but then who I am. Kayami was Sanatan Goswami's question to Lord Chaitanya. Please tell me who I am. So the whole science of the soul is presented immediately by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatan Goswami. So, again, maybe you meant what you said, but if you meant what you said, yeah, because on the strength of the teachings of our of Srimad Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita and our spiritual scriptures, there is a sense that we can answer the question, "Who are you?" That's not born of false ego. I am the eternal servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Chaitanya says of the gopis, Gopi Bhartur, Kamalayor Dasa Das Anudas, who are the so many times removed servant of the dear servants of the Supreme Lord. That's who we are eternally. That's our identity. Now, living in this world, I may accept some other temporary identities, like one of the ones that Lord Chaitanya said that he's not. One is not a householder, one is not a sannyasi, one is not a whatever, whatever. We live with those things and we utilize those psychophysical nature things, the covering things. That's what's being said in this verse. For such a person, a transcendentalist, can live in that sea of matter and act in Krishna consciousness the whole while. It's not their Krishna consciousness need not be compromised, provided sarvadrik. They're seeing Krishna in all those things, and even the temporary things. The previous verses explain how that is done. Go ahead. Yeah. Well, yes, the responsibility as well as the conception of self. I positively exist. Now, in an impersonalist, it's not so much different from a voidist. A voidist says there is no self. What's the ultimate reality? Nothingness. When I become an enlightened soul, I realize there is nothing. Yummy, huh? And then the impersonalist says, I realize that I am Brahman. Of course, Brahman is the supreme. That's pretty good. I'm supreme. But, you know, individuality, no individuality. I am the supreme. Brahman. I am Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi. So a devotee is dasosmi. I'm the servant. Yes. It's fantastic. Go ahead. We did that at your home.
Well, I was hoping, I can't come up with a reason why someone would make up such a fantastic description.
But?
I was wondering if you'd ever heard of, in your many years propagating Krishna consciousness, anyone who doubted that description based on some metaphorical...
No.
...allegorical...
The only thing that I came across that's kind of outstanding, maybe somebody in the room will remember the name. There was or is a Harvard professor, it's not the one that's in the wheelchair, who had this like TV show, and he was talking about Big Bang and
Carl Sagan.
Thank you. Carl Sagan especially liked the Vedas. And one of the things he liked about the Vedas is that time is cyclical. So, and the time is cyclical model, he liked the idea that as the universe expands and expands and expands, then it reaches its furthest extremity of expansion, then it implodes upon itself and goes back to, of course, you know, for him it's a big bang, it's a singularity. So he's not, you know, Vishnu is the cause or the source of the universes, it's the big bang, And then it expands and expands and comes back to a singularity. He liked that model. He liked the Vedas because he liked that. He liked, and some other things about the Vedas. Except he didn't like Vishnu. Yes? You had some further thoughts on that question? You're a very thoughtful person, I can tell. Yes.
Actually, it is mentioned as 864,000 years, right?
I'm listening.
And the Kali Yuga stated as 432 years.
42,000.
432,000 years.
Yeah.
So why can't, you know, like the Dwapara Yuga is actually like, why can't it surpass the 864 mark? Why can't it be like 865?
Why not? You know, if you were a creator, would you make something that's random or systematic? It's systematic. Here's how it goes. It's multiples of 10. Multiples of 10. So 432, and here's another nice thing. It's just numerology. But Kali Yuga is 432,000 years, correct? And then you add another 432, and then you add another 432,000. You add 432,000. So it's 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4. How many is that? It's 10. 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1 is 10. Isn't that neat? And you want it to be,
433. My question is like, Mani is saying according to the people's misuse of their free will, that is how the degradation happens.
Yeah.
That is the case, is that really mandatory that people have to degrade after 1864?
Well, it's not like they have to, it's just they do. Here's another metaphor. You know what a whirlpool is? So you put something on the outside of the metaphor this morning was a bucket of paint. This one is a whirlpool. So you put something on the outside of the whirlpool. What happens? It goes around in a circle slowly. But it goes faster, 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 and down and down. Right? Similarly, Satya Yuga, it goes at the speed that it goes on. It's the time energy of the Supreme Lord that moves matter. So that's, it's the time energy is moving matter. Now your question, the foundational question that you were asking is it dictated by the Supreme Lord or is it in reciprocation with the desire of living entities? I understood your question. And it's not, and my answer was, he's reciprocating with the living entities who desire to enjoy independently, so it's got a time energy that moves it. Because otherwise living entities can't do anything. You can't get up and walk across the floor. Even if you gotta, pass water, you can't. you can't. Unless the time energy permits you and the Lord sanctions. So, this is his system, and then the higher living entities, time works differently, and lower living entities, it spins faster. Their lifespan is shorter. It's the time energy moving. So it's the time energy, the clock that allows it to happen, but it's the living entities' desire. The lower life forms have darker desires. The higher life forms have desires of more light. And so their life cycle is longer. It's really practical. Maybe we'll nominate you for the post of Brahma next lifetime or something. You're very thoughtful. Yes.
Why did Gautama Muni leave home when he had the Supreme Lord as his son?
It's a mystery, isn't it? Well, the answer is, that he, you understand the question? Why is he going to the forest to meditate upon the Supreme when his son is the Supreme? He doesn't have to go anywhere. He just stay home. Because he's setting an example. Great souls set example. He didn't have to. Even when before he asked permission from Swami Bhuvamano, I'll accept your daughter's, the responsibility of your daughter in marriage. But when there is a son who we already knew was going to be the personality of Godhead. So he's setting an example. He's setting an example. There otherwise, I mean, and not only that, he has parental affection. He has Vatsalya Rasa. That's why Kapila became his son. And he's leaving home. So then there's this separation, intensification of his feelings through separation. That's another. He's under the direction of the Supreme Lord. That's another bigger way of saying the same thing. And why? But why would the Supreme Lord indicate that? Kapila Dev is going to leave also. Devahuti understood that. He's not going to stay. So while you're still here, please give me the instruction of how I can be safe and protected when you're gone. And his answer is, stay always in the association of devotees. Something else? Yes?
They're asking very critical questions, but mine, I don't know, I can ask that now. He said, like, Maharaj, that if we are doing something wrong that we know that is wrong, still we are doing, that a weak heart.
Yeah.
And how to make the heart beautiful?
Oh, very good question. Well, it's the combination of cleansing the heart, guided by proper knowledge. Those two things. So for us, the cleansing of the heart is Maha Mantra. Cheto Darpana Marjanam. That's our heart cleansing activity. And then be guided by proper knowledge. That's our study of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and devotional teachings. And Prabhupada used this metaphor. It's a visual metaphor. I like visual things. So, a train can move on two train tracks. Of course, now they make monorails, but on two tracks. And without one of the two tracks, the train isn't going to move. It will collapse. So, similarly, for spiritual progress, to move from the weakness of heart to the other, exactly what Arjuna was happening with Arjuna, Krishna is giving him knowledge, Bhagavad Gita, to shore up, the proper conduct. So, cleansing the heart is necessary. But Prabhupada's explanation is that when there's cleansing of the heart but not proper knowledge, then there's sentiment that can become fanaticism. In the world, religious fanaticism is wild. And it's not new. It's been going on for a long time. In the name of religion, awful things. If you cannot properly guide it. So you need the cleansing of the heart, but you also need proper knowledge. And there's just proper knowledge without the cleansing of the heart. It's speculative, dry. So you need both. And when you have both, there's something that propels and there's something that guides. The pure heart is that it inspires us to go beyond the weakness of heart, but then properly guide it. Not only how to, but then when we're moving, how to apply ourselves. We stay fixed rather than becoming proud or complacent. I'm feeling comfortable. Que sera, sera. I'm okay, you're okay. We're interested in continuing and continuing and continuing and extending to others. And, you know, Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan, giving the same wonderful opportunity to others. It's the life of transcendental knowledge. Vidyavadhu jivanam. That's the sign. So when when you receive that, then you want to give that. Then it's no, you know, weakness of heart is overcome by continuing to act in that compassionate giving. Not I'm big, you're small, I'm going to help you out, but compassionate, be moved by the inspiration of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That's those two things. So focus on those two things, and one can overcome the weakness of heart. Yes. Turn the volume up a little. Proper guidance. Association of devotees. Of course, if you're a nice devotee, you have a nice devotee wife, and she'll help you too. That's a wonderful resource, and an essential resource that our founder Acharya has created is a sangha of devotees. Especially look to those devotees who you know and you have a special confidence in, that this person is going to Krishna. They're very sincere, they're very committed, they're very dedicated. This person is going to Krishna. They may not be with Krishna fully yet, but that's where they're going. They're clear. And they're you know, the qualities, the compassionate, so then you just go to that person or those persons and you invite them into your life and say, if you see me heading off the middle of the road and I'm heading for the ditch, can you please, you know, tap me on the shoulder and get me back to the middle of the road? And they'll say, well, as long as you're comfortable with me tapping you on the shoulder, because some people aren't. They're heading off the side of the road and somebody taps them on the shoulder and they get angry. Right? I know what I'm doing. False ego. So being guided by persons that are proximate, one of my favorite sayings of Bhakti Tirtha Swami is, to raise a child, it takes a village. So there are persons who may be, you know, there's a spiritual master who you can take guidance from, but there's all the other, you know, wonderful devotees that one can take guidance from. Let's not discount those wonderful devotees that one can take guidance from to make sure that we're, you know, heading in a proper way. And a close companion, like husband, wife, the purpose of marriage is fundamentally that, to help one another progress towards Krishna. Fundamentally. And so, wives know about husbands, and husbands know about wives, and they know things that other people don't know. And so, they can be of assistance. They are very, very valuable assistant in, that's what transcendental picture of what marriage is for, not mutually satisfying one another's desires, but working together to satisfy Krishna and advance in Krishna consciousness. Okay? You have something? Yeah?
Are you clear what the question is? Because I'm not. Are you clear? Yeah, okay.
Try it again. You're using a term at the very beginning. Doppler, is that what you're saying? Dwarpa Yuga. Okay, I'm thinking Doppler? That's something else. Okay. So in Dwarpa Yuga, what happens?
So it is like slowly degrade
as... Yes, yes. It's not like, you know, there's a floor, there's the first step, there's the second step. It's not like that. It's sloping. In other words, towards the beginning of Kali Yuga, life duration is how long? 100 years max. Read in the Bhagavatam, what's towards the end? 20 years is max. 12th canto. Let's do some other math. Numbers. So, you've heard Prabhupada say, when Krishna was on the battlefield of Kurukshetra with Arjuna, how old was he? You've heard the number. 125. Anyone else has heard that number? 125. So, listen carefully. After the Kurukshetra battle was over, Gandhari was sitting with Dhritarashtra. And she was angry. She lost her 100 sons. And she was feeling angry and very sad and very angry. So she called for Bhima. And Bhima came. And she let Bhima have it. You know, what kind of religious personality are you? Look what you did. Fighting in a religious battle in some, you know, against the codes of Kshatriya, and you've destroyed my son, you're going to suffer greatly. And very calmly, Bhima said, my dear mother, for one who has done what your son has done, death penalty is sure to be given. And the fact that I did what I did, it was under the authority of Krishna. One who acts under the authority of Krishna, he's acting within Dharma. But my dear mother, it is you, because you knew all the wicked deeds that he had done, attempted murder in so many ways and so many vicious things, and disrobing Draupadi in the public assembly, and you did nothing. You have to accept the responsibility for his misdeed, which he's now earned. She was silent. But her anger was still there. Though she thought, Bhima would never have done this without Yudhisthira giving his sanction. Bring Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira was of a different mood. He right away, I've done horrible things, and I'm ready to be punished. Whatever punishment you want to give, I accept it. So she lifted her blindfold a little bit and looked at the feet of Yudhisthira, and his feet burned, his toes and tips of his toes and toenails just like closed the blindfold. She wasn't satisfied. Yudhisthira would not have done what Yudhisthira did, and Bhima would not have done what Bhima did if it wasn't for Krishna. She asked Krishna to come. She said so many things, and Krishna said so many things, but in part of her discussion with Krishna, she said, as I have had to suffer, it's like a curse, but who can curse Krishna? Like I have had to suffer the loss of my entire family, you will also have to incur the loss of your entire family. And it will happen in 36 years. She gave a number. Now, why it wasn't 37 or 35, we have to ask Gandhari. But 36 years. So 36 years later is when the Yadu dynasty was destroyed, Prabhas Kshetra. So, and then shortly after that, Krishna went to the place where Uddhava met him, and then immediately after that, Krishna left. So that's towards the end of Dwarpa Yuga. So it's 125 plus 36. Math in your mind. How many? One, how many? 161. 161. So how long is the life duration in Dwarpa Yuga? 1,000. But towards the end, it's 161. So does that answer your question? Okay. Anything else? Yes. Yes.
So there are times when, we may not have that.
And it's the other way around. Go ahead. Every now and then we may have a flash or a moment of spiritual conception. Go ahead. You pause. Mode of goodness. No, since we're conditioned souls, it would be a really long pause. So, but when you recognize, just like when you're chanting japa and you recognize that your mind has drifted, what does Krishna say? And you do what Krishna says. You bring the mind back from whatever and wherever the mind wanders. And you just, you know, abhyasa. You just keep practicing that. So same. It doesn't have to be like, you know, a spaced-out pause, it just, you go into a reflective mode. Mode of goodness. Let me remember Krishna. Let me remember my position as Krishna's servant. Where is he? Oh, there. Let me remember my position as Krishna's servant. And then now, what is an appropriate service for me to be doing in this circumstance kind of thing? You just practice and practice and it becomes second nature. It happens very quickly. You know, without utter practice, it takes a while. Like, you know, learning to drive a car or learning to ride a bicycle or you know, anything. She had her hand up first. Would you like that? Oh, okay. Yes. He. How many days?
Yeah.
Same number of days. Same number of days. Yeah, 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 yeah. But more years per lifetime in Dwarpa Yuga. 1,000 years with the same 365 days per year. Okay, that's your question. Yes.
How do we know?
Just assume that you have. Safe assumption. the opposite is all. It's you know, the other side of the pan scale is strong feelings of humility in calling out for Krishna. That's not complacent. So when that's not there, complacency is there. Okay, looks like we're done. Srila Prabhupada ki?
Jai.
Jai.